At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's a phrase that last year some on Wall Street thought they might never hear again. General Motors reported second quarter profits today. $1.3 billion worth, in fact. Compare that to a $13 billion loss in the same period last year, and you have to wonder, are the big three back? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 12th day of August. So here are the undeniable signs of progress emanating from General Motors today. There's that $1.3 billion in profits I just mentioned. Second quarter in a row of good news from the balance sheet. There is also word on the street that the company will file papers for an IPO as soon as tomorrow. And CEO Ed Whitaker announced he will step down on September 1st, little more than a year after being tapped by the Obama administration to help turn GM around. Board member Daniel Akerson will succeed him. Joining us from New York to talk about what all this means for GM and the Big Three is our own Alisa Roth. Hi, Alisa.
Hello, Tess.
Remind us where GM was when it declared bankruptcy last summer. I know we're going back in history a little bit, but...
We are, and you have to remember that GM's troubles started well before bankruptcy and well before the financial crisis. For starters, it had too many factories. It had too many workers who were costing the company tons of money. It was building far more vehicles than the market needed, which meant that it had to offer all kinds of incentives in order to sell those vehicles. Mm-hmm. And there were too many dealers trying to sell those vehicles. Meanwhile, despite or because of all this, the company was actually losing market share. And I mean, there was a period where it seemed like it could actually go out of business.
And it wasn't the only one that it seemed could go out of business. I mean, the big three were really in a lot of trouble. But here we are, barely a year later, and at least General Motors is posting a profit of $1.3 billion in the second quarter, possibly getting ready for a huge IPO. What happened?
Well, as one of my sources put it, GM went through a big rinse cycle. Michael Robinette is an auto analyst at IHS Global Insight. He says GM and the other Detroit carmakers, to some extent, have finally figured it out.
In terms of building residual value, building better product, making sure your facilities are better utilized, and really focusing more on the bottom line rather than expanding the top line.
So what that means in practical terms is it renegotiated with the unions on both salaries and on benefits, which was at least as important. It shut down a lot of plants. It really streamlined the manufacturing process, so it's making vehicles more cheaply. It got rid of half of its brands so it can focus much more on the brands it kept. And it's cut its dealer network by about 25%. Hmm. There are two other key factors here. One is that bankruptcy let GM wipe out its debt, so it really got to start over. The other thing is GM is finally building vehicles that drivers want.
Well, it certainly sounds like things are now going swimmingly for GM. And, of course, Ford has been in repair for the last year as well. So back to GM, when they do the IPO, should we be rushing to invest?
Maybe. I mean, first of all, we should remember that the auto industry globally is doing much, much better than it was. Mm-hmm. So yes, GM is doing very well, but it's partly because the whole industry is in better shape. I asked Michael Robinette that same question you asked me. He says he thinks the heavy lifting at GM has been done, that the company just needs to keep pushing its plans forward, maybe make a few minor tweaks. But GM does still have some real issues to deal with. Sales are up so far this year, but they're up less than the industry average. Sales at rival Ford are up about twice as much as at GM. And GM is also still paying above average incentives on its vehicles. Still, GM is convinced that things are moving in the right direction. Of course, it says that.
Right.
But it's hopeful that, among other things, an IPO will get it out from its government ownership, which GM at least thinks is key.
All right. Marketplace's Elisa Roth joining us from our New York bureau. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So as we just mentioned, GM does plan to relaunch as a public company in the not-too-distant future. Pretty soon, you could be buying shares, which is a little strange since taxpayers already essentially own GM, 61% of it. And that got us wondering what Uncle Sam's involvement in a company means for investors. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look.
Uncle Sam can be a little difficult for investors to escape these days. The government owns stakes in companies from General Motors to Citigroup. Lawrence Kotlikoff is an economist at Boston University. He says there are a lot of benefits to having the state as a stakeholder.
The government is, in effect, saying, look, if a company runs out of money, we, the government, will bail it out.
Kotlikoff says it also makes it a lot easier for those companies to borrow money. Just today, GM announced it's borrowing $5 billion to help it go public. And all that is great in the short term. The long term is another story.
You're kind of getting into bed with an 800-pound gorilla. You're partnering, in effect, with an investor who's got other objectives than you have.
The government might want to control executive pay or pursue other agendas. Mark Kaufeld is the president of Empiric Advisors. He says that's been the problem with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Instead of trying to make them profitable, the government is using them to help stimulate the housing economy.
The government is not in the profit business. They're in the political business. The economy runs on risk. It runs on capitalism. And that's really what we need today. And when the government steps in, they take away that capitalism.
But the government is usually careful not to get too involved. And financial analyst Ray Perryman says it generally wants to extricate itself over time.
They do walk a very fine line there because they are public resources. You want them to benefit the public. By the same token, in the long run, the worst thing they could do to benefit the public is impose practices that are going to limit profitability.
After all, Perryman says the whole point of the government taking over GM was to turn it around and make it a profitable public company once again. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The makers of the BlackBerry have been losing ground against Apple and Android in the battle to dominate the smartphone market. And now the company Research in Motion is also facing harsh criticism from governments about encryption on BlackBerry devices. It's so good, the story goes, it represents a security threat. Steve Henn tells us what began as a key selling point has morphed into the company's Achilles heel.
Research in Motion, the makers of BlackBerry, were pioneers in the smartphone business long before smartphones were cool. Years before anyone imagined an iPhone or Google Android, lawyers in Washington were CrackBerry addicts.
And also Wall Street, the traders and other folks like that, for whom certainly the security of their communications about trades and the like, crucial.
Charles Galvin's an analyst at Forrester Research. He says from the beginning, a key part of BlackBerry's sales pitch was that its messages sent on its devices are safe.
BlackBerry phones in particular have an end-to-end encryption solution built into them. A lot of your other phone manufacturers, such as Apple or Google Android, out of the box, don't have that level of encryption of their data.
Tyler Shields is a security researcher for Veracode. He says Research in Motion even built its own data network to handle BlackBerry traffic. And all this drives intelligence agencies around the world crazy. The United Arab Emirates tried to hack its way in. They offered BlackBerry users there a patch that was in fact a piece of spyware. When that failed, the UAE threatened to shut BlackBerry out entirely. This month, RIM reached a deal there, and now India's demanding concessions too. But analyst Charles Galvin says any new deals could be dangerous for a company whose core business is built around the promise of absolutely secure communication.
For them to wilt on it in any way, shape, or form is going to undermine that core.
Yet with hundreds of millions of possible customers in India, reaching an agreement there has to be tempting. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
BP has agreed to pay a record $50 million fine for safety lapses that led to a deadly oil refinery explosion in Texas 5 years ago. The settlement with the Labor Department also requires BP to spend another $500 million on safety upgrades by 2016. On Wall Street, a third straight day of declines as investors worried about first-time claims for unemployment benefits. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Just north of Los Angeles, over the San Gabriel Mountains, lies an enormous desert parking lot. Hundreds of idled aircraft sit gathering dust and sand. Airlines trimmed their fleets as the recession hit. They had to put the planes somewhere, and the desert now resembles LA's 405 freeway at rush hour. But cargo and passenger volume are up, and a few major airlines are pulling mothballed 747s out of storage and back into service. Janet Babin reports on whether that's a signal that the industry is officially in recovery mode.
The 747 is like the movie star of the jumbo airline fleet, a double-decker jet with an iconic bulb on top. When it first debuted, the upstairs was like a VIP club.
It was the glamorous area with large seats, an open bar. Back in the early 70s, there were even grand pianos.
That's Andy Golub, head of risk advisory for aircraft consulting company Ascend. He says when the recession made its descent, these long-haul jumbo jets were among the first idled, but now they're coming back. A 747 can hold a lot of first-class international travelers and a lot of cargo. That makes them efficient at adding capacity without adding cost. Ascend's Andy Golub says passenger and cargo volumes are up, and a number of carriers, British Airways, United, have returned jumbos to the fleet.
We're not going to necessarily see all the jumbo jets return to service, but the fact that they're putting one and two and three and four aircraft back into their route networks is very strong for the message going into the next year.
It could signal recovery or just an anecdotal jump. And if airlines put too many planes back in the air too fast, they could lose money. Passengers, on the other hand, stand to win from the additional seats. Richard Abulafia is an aviation analyst at the Teal Group.
Individual airlines may decide that adding capacity is a great idea, but if too many of them do it, that hurts pricing. So we're going to have to wait and see. But if they do dump a lot of capacity in the system, that definitely means cheaper fares.
For now, though, passengers can expect stable fares and full planes, despite the added jumbos. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We were talking earlier about the government's gradual relinquishment of ownership in General Motors. In these days of government intervention in private industry, it might be hard to imagine, but one public sector is undergoing radical privatization. Police departments across the country are finding themselves supplemented, and in some cases supplanted, by private security firms. Simon Hakim of Temple University has studied the issue, and he says in the early 70s, there were seven police officers for every four private security guards. Today, it's one officer for every three private guards.
The main reason is that the police at state and local level, the budget pretty much stayed fixed over time. Now, the demand for security have grown, even by municipalities, and municipalities start to feel the budget crunch. So the result of it is that a lot of security that governments require, governments started to contract it out to private agencies. For example, guarding prisoners, guarding even police station and the other type of installations.
I know in the article that you talk about how part of the problem is that traditional police forces aren't quick enough to react to new threats, for example, identity theft.
That's right. In other words, up to now, we talked about the low-level security that private security guards enter into it. Now we have more sophisticated crime, like identity theft, like internet crime. The police doesn't deal with it anymore at all. So private security forces got into it. But it's further. A lot of those investigations require high-caliber professionals, accountants, IT people, lawyers, etc., that the police has difficult recruiting because of limited budget. And they can never pay the high salary that the private sector does.
But there are still a lot of crimes that private security forces certainly cannot tackle. I mean, murder, breaking and entering, that sort of thing.
In the last 20 years, we've seen a drop of 25% in property and violent crime. That's traditionally being handled by our police departments. So what you're really facing is that the traditional work of the police has been going down because they have less crime to deal with.
So where does this go from here? Would you predict, based on your research, that we will see more and more police forces going into private hands?
I believe it's true. The police is a monopoly. It's less innovative than the private sector that is under the gun of competition. A police department will never go bankrupt. Private company could go bankrupt. So private companies adopt more technology. I expect that we may find contracting out of small police departments, because a lot of small police departments really don't have the justification in many cases to exist. And for the consumers, they get better service in much lower cost.
Simon Hakim is a professor of economics at Temple University and the co-author of Privatizing the Police in the third quarter edition of the Milken Institute Review. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Coming up, a meatpacking plant that equates success with hiring only U.S. citizens.
Unfortunately, the city of Postville is full of illegals. I know that as a fact, and you just have to be double careful.
But first, let's do the numbers. A potential rise in unemployment held the markets down for a third day today. The Dow dropped another 58 points, 0.5% to finish at 10,319. The NASDAQ clicked down 18 points, 0.8% to close at 2190. And the S&P 500 ticked down 5 points, 0.5% to end the day at 1083. Citigroup banked a 0.5% gain. Goldman Sachs and JPMorgan Chase inched up 0.1%. Telecoms did relatively well today. Verizon rang up 2.5% gain. AT&T rose 0.4%. Elizabeth Arden wafted up 10.5% after its perfume lines for stars Mariah Carey and Britney Spears brought in bigger-than-expected profits. Oops, they did it again. Bonds fell, and the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.75%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for July. What are consumers paying for stuff? The Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index for July. And it's Friday the 13th, a good day to eat, pray, love. It opens in theaters. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. A report out this week from the Pew Hispanic Center is sure to fuel the debate over repeal of the 14th Amendment. That's the section of the Constitution that grants automatic citizenship to any baby born in the United States. The Pew study says last year, 340,000 of those babies were born to at least one parent who was in this country illegally. That's nearly 1 in 12 newborns. Marketplace's Amy Scott looks at what that might mean for the economy.
The Federation for American Immigration Reform is one group that wants Congress to change the 14th Amendment so that only babies born to U.S. citizens and legal residents get automatic citizenship. Spokesman Ira Melman says children born to illegal immigrants cost taxpayers billions of dollars in social services.
By and large, we're talking about a population that earns very low incomes, and their children, their U.S. citizen children, are entitled to a full range of benefits as a result of the low incomes that their parents have.
But immigrants without papers pay taxes, too. Stephen Camerata is with the Center for Immigration Studies. His group favors fewer immigrants but better treatment of those who are here. Camerata says a few years ago he calculated that undocumented immigrants pay about $16 billion a year to the federal government in various taxes.
Unfortunately, they were creating about $26 billion in costs at the federal level, and many of those costs are associated with their U.S.-born children.
But Camerata says even if those kids weren't automatic citizens, taxpayers would cover a lot of the costs anyway, like access to emergency health care and public education. He says the solution isn't revoking their right to citizenship, but doing a better job of keeping their parents from coming here. Critics of automatic citizenship, like Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, say it's a magnet that draws people across the border. Some refer to the children born to these immigrants as anchor babies, who make it easier for family members to come to the U.S. But advocates for undocumented immigrants say people simply come here for opportunity. Doris Meissner with the Migration Policy Institute says many are here several years before starting families.
To equate this with the idea that people cross the border in order to give birth to a U.S. citizen child, that is not an accurate reflection of what's going on.
Meissner says it's no surprise that so many babies are born to undocumented workers. They tend to be young and therefore more likely to have babies. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The meatpacking business is one of the most famous, or more accurately, notorious, employers of illegal immigrants. One morning in 2008, federal agents walked into a kosher meatpacking plant in northeast Iowa. A few hours later, they walked out with almost 400 people. At the time, it was the biggest immigration raid in U.S. history. For the tiny town of Postville and its main employer, it was devastating. Now, 2 years later, the plant is getting back on its feet, trying to operate on the up and up. Jeff Horwich reports on how the company moved on without the workers that traditionally power its industry.
When the agriprocessors plant first went on the block in bankruptcy, nobody seemed to want it. The country's number one name in kosher meat had become a pariah with customers. Maybe worse, it was cut off from the cheap, hard-working labor the whole place was built on. Then, a year ago, one lone bidder flew in from Canada and bought the plant for a steal.
A company that's running has no challenges. I love a challenge.
Hershey Friedman is a turnaround specialist. He's snapped up packaging, printing, and computer businesses around the world. And he's an Orthodox Jew, which is why he felt a particular mission to make Postville work.
Slowly, slowly, we're progressing and getting there. This is a humongous facility.
Friedman changed the name. Agriprocessors became AgriStar. He spent $10 million, that's more than his purchase price, just to rebuild the beef line. All that's pretty straightforward. Staffing the place, not so much.
Unfortunately, the city of Postville is full of illegals. I know that as a fact, and you just have to be double careful.
Workers caught in the 2008 raid were deported, but many of their families and workers who weren't caught stayed in the area. They want work, but Friedman says AgriStar is 100% under the microscope, which makes it an experiment worth watching. Can you run a packing plant in rural America on only legal labor?
You can do it. It's a big job, but you have to do it, okay? Look at it this way. You don't have a choice.
After the evening shift change at AgriStar, Somali men fill a small park down the street. Almost all moved to Postville from Minneapolis, 4 hours away.
I had these companies hiring people. I came and applied for it, and I started working from there.
Abdallah Omar estimates more than a third of AgriStar workers now are Somali. He works on the newly restarted beef line and says it's getting busier.
When I started, it was We used to work 6 hours, but now usually we get like 8 hours daily. I started $850, but now I get paid more. I get a raise.
Before the raid, many undocumented workers made minimum wage. Today, jobs at AgriStar start at $2 above it. These Somalis say the plant is a safe place to work, high praise in the meatpacking world. But luring and keeping good workers is not easy. The owner, Friedman, says turnover is going down, that there's enough legal labor in town. Workers like Derek Cobbins see it differently.
They go through a lot of workers, I just say that. You know, a lot of workers.
Cobbins is one of a handful of native-born Americans working on the floor. He moved here from Dubuque soon after the raid. He says the plant's hiring system still has holes. Workers with fake documents are getting through.
They're still putting them to work, and they know this. They only work, what, 2 to 3 weeks or months? And then they're still looking for more people, you know.
Is that because they find out that they're illegal and they have to get rid of them?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Each worker found out means weeks of training down the drain. Stepped-up drug testing nixes other workers. And many in town worry whether the new arrivals have the work ethic for often brutal meatpacking jobs. There's a palpable nostalgia for the days when Postville teemed with dependable, undocumented workers, Guatemalans in particular.
Yes, they were illegal, but they were good people.
Dean Olaf sits on his front steps, a half block off the main drag. He's active in Postville civic life and works for a feed company nearby.
They were family-oriented. They were hard workers. You could depend on them. They were there every day.
Olaf and others are frustrated their town and their plant are hamstrung, that AgriStar can't just hire the immigrants willing to get the job done. Right now, AgriStar is losing money. The owner, Friedman, says it will be for some time. Olaf is rooting for him.
Sometimes in a small community, you're looking for things to be proud of. You know, we're looking for that happy ending. We're looking for something positive to come back out of this.
The hope now, far-fetched maybe, is that Postville might be known for something else, as the packing plant town that came back from near death and did it legit. In Postville, Iowa, I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, for those of you who've always wanted to own your own pub, there's one for sale in the UK. But the Old Forge is no ordinary watering hole, as co-owner Jackie Robertson explains.
We're 7 miles up a sea loch on the very west coast of Scotland. You can only get to us by boat. And there are several munros, which are hills over 3,500 feet, which you can only pass by, if you're a trekker, a rambler, a hill walker.
Now, you may be asking yourself, well, then how do they manage to make any money at all? Turns out cruise ship passengers like a tipple every now and then. And the Old Forge is ideally situated for that kind of outing. The beer is cold, and you can say you drank at what the Guinness Book of World Records lists as the most remote pub on mainland UK. If you are interested in buying the place, asking price is £790,000 sterling, about $1.2 million. And oh, what a celebration they'll have if you do.
I'll go and have a dram, a good whiskey, in the pub.
Aye, cheers, lads. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 58 points. That's 0.5%. The Nasdaq fell 18 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 lost 5 points. That's 0.5%. Our editors include John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, how Universal Studios' new Harry Potter attraction is bringing in more money and people than they imagined.
I'm sure they're thrilled that the crowds are there, but I think they were just really blindsided by how many people would show up.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.